Happy Tuesday. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And this week, I'm really missing my shows from the road. For the last 5 summers, my husband and I have packed up the car and head out to new places around the country and had the opportunity to meet some incredibly interesting people, see new places, and bring those stories home to you. And although I haven't been able to get on the road this year, I've been saving this one conversation for today because I had the opportunity to meet this gentleman a year ago on our trip through Idaho and Montana, and it was such an intensely personal and important conversation that I wanted to make sure I saved it for just the right time. And I believe the right time is now. With all that is going on in the world, I think it's important for us to remember that we can find common ground with almost any person. And no one is a stranger as soon as you hear part of their story. And that's exactly what I felt with Jim. So last year, part of our road trip took us through Ashton, Idaho. Beautiful country, eastern Idaho, right next to the Tetons. Most of that area is kind of flat and plain-like, and you look out to the Tetons, just gorgeous. And it's really well known for fly fishing. I'm not a huge fly fishing person, but after spending some time there, I have really found my curiosity piqued. And one of the reasons is because we met a man named Jim Christensen. Now, the first time I met Jim, he walked into our friend's house and he was wearing shorts, a Hawaiian shirt, and cowboy boots. He had the warmest smile, easy way about him, and we quickly struck up a conversation. And he started to tell me about his life and his interest in fly fishing and why he lives in Ashton, Idaho. And I said, wait, don't tell me your story yet. I want to sit down and have an opportunity to record what you have to say. And so we met up in Jim's expansive workshop where he builds custom fly fishing boats, beautiful hand-welded boats, and it's his passion. And so we had this conversation about his life, and I thought we would mostly be talking about fly fishing, but as it turned out, there was a lot more to Jim than his passion and love for fly fishing. So although we won't be taking calls today, you can still be part of the conversation by sending me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can follow us on Facebook. Check out our Instagram, elizabeth_TRT. I actually have a couple pictures of Jim posted there. You can also listen to previous shows by visiting kcbx.org under the program archives or podcast our show. It will be uploaded so you can listen at your convenience. And if you get a chance, leave a review so other people can find our show. So thank you for tuning in and supporting Central Coast Public Radio KCBX. We'll be back in a moment to start our conversation with Jim Christensen in Ashton, Idaho.
Up this morning before the sun, fix me some coffee and a honey bun, jump in my pickup, gave her the gas, I'm going out to catch a 5-pound bass. Down by the lakeside, just off the ramp, all them people sleeping in their fishing camp. Some out in the pup tents, some out on the grass. They all be dreaming about the 5-pound bass. Dirty birdie always gets his worm. Me, I always get my wish. When you talk about that 5-pound
bass. I had a good life. I had a great mother, had a great family. My father was not in my life, but that's okay, because when I met him later, I was glad that he wasn't.
Your mom had done you a favor in some ways.
Correct. Yeah. He was just young and he wasn't ready for that. So,
do you have siblings?
Nope. I'm an only child.
So you and your mom were a team.
Yep. And my grandmother was a big deal. She was a big part of it. And, my mom was being a single mom and owning a home. She worked 2 jobs and that kind of thing. So I had a grandmother who was a retired school teacher, and so she took me all over the world, like not over the world, but like all over the country, and always kept me busy, and so that was a good thing. That was I got to do a lot of really amazing things that kids wouldn't get to do.
Like what?
Like we would take For instance, she would take me, and she, when I was 14, she took me and dropped me off at a fly shop in Montana.
Okay.
And she
did she know the owner of the fly shop? Oh, really?
Yeah, she had called ahead and said, I have a kid who's fascinated in fly fishing, and he's fascinated, just totally consumed with fly fishing. It's all he lives for. Could you use some help this summer? And the guy said, yep, he can live with me. We'll sleep on the floor. We slept in cots. We cooked over a Coleman stove in the back of this little rinky-dink fly shop. And I worked there for 2.5 months, from the day I got out of sixth grade to the day I got out of seventh grade. And I washed boats. The rule was, we ate breakfast together. We got all the customers out. We got them to the river. He had a boat rental company on the Bighorn River, and this is way back in the early 80s. He had a boat rental company on the Bighorn River, and so the contract was, we got all the customers to the river, got them into their boats. We got all the trailers back. We washed all the trailers. The rest of the day was mine, from late morning till early afternoon, when all the boats started to show back up at the takeouts. And then I had to come back, and we went and we harvested all the boats. I washed every boat by hand, and there was quite a few of them, in the teens, I would say. And then if we got it done early and there was still time, we would both go fishing. And he was a really nice guy.
Are you still in contact with him?
Nope. Okay. And I actually, I only did that for 2 years. And then my mom was nice enough to sign me up for fishing in Bristol Bay with the same kind of deal, but now I was going to make money. So,
but I'm curious, so what did you do? Like, did you just fish all day between your jobs in Montana?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you were that into it.
Yeah.
And introduced you to fly fishing to begin with?
Yeah. It was on TV.
Come on.
No, I'm not kidding. Like, my mom would always, my dad used to take my mom fishing.
Okay.
And so my mom took me fishing, bait fishing with a worm and stuff, to the lake when I was a little guy. And there was a TV show one time, and these guys were just catching tons of fish. And I said, Mom, that's what I want to do. And the next day, she had a fly rod and a fly reel, and she said, go do it. So okay. I used to fish off the beach. I used to fish all these little irrigation ditches and creeks and, you know, sewage runoff pipes probably, and whatever we had running water and for fish. And I just consumed with it. And that's why I'm here technically in Ashton. Me and my wife bought a house in Chester, which is just right down the road, 10 minutes away. We moved here. We chose this place because of the unbelievable fishing. We're both avid fly fishermen, and it's a small place.
So fishing, because I'm going to back up, because all of a sudden you're in Chester. But so you worked in Montana for 2 years, mm-hmm. and then you're now 16, probably right around then. All right, then what was the next?
So then, when I was done in Montana, it was time for me to make a little bit of money. My mom was very. She wanted me to always have my own money and mm-hmm. have the pride of creating something. She really instilled the create it and get paid for it and see that whole circle. And that's a really tough circle to teach. Create something and then you get paid for it and everyone's happy, and you do it again, you get paid again, and you do it again, and you get paid again. It's a real hard thing to teach some people. Some people just don't have the motivation to do it. So my mom signed me up for a job right off the bat. She had me slinging sockeye salmon on the back deck of a boat with a guy, again, I had never met. He was a guy that she worked with, and I don't know what he did. I think he drove a forklift at the place that she was used to be an accountant, and I think he drove a forklift there or something. We didn't talk a lot. We weren't really friends that much. But I fished with him for 10 years and really never really knew anything about him. Like, and I don't, even if I did, I don't remember it anymore. But so then I would do that during the summers. Now that's not the whole summer. So that's like a month and a half, 3 weeks, depending on the season. And the rest of the time, my grandmother kept me busy. Rock hounding, we would go look for rocks. We would that was her hobby, is to, I don't know, whatever you want to call it, picking up rocks and yeah.
So clearly your mom and your grandmother were all about raising a boy to a man. Like, it seems like it was very intentional. They wanted you to have a lot of skills and a lot of work ethic or a lot of work experiences. And so when you graduated from high school, and did you like living in Puget Sound area?
I did.
Okay.
But then I hadn't lived anywhere else, so I made the best of what there was there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean.
So once you graduated from high school, where did you then set out into the world?
So I got, so all I've ever done my whole life since the beginning, since I was a little kid, was be fascinated with boats. Boats, fascination with boats. There's a boat out here in the back that I built when I was 18 years old.
It's still sitting there.
It's never even had a motor on it. And I'm going to finish it this year. But.
And what kind of boats were you fascinated with? Was it specific or any boat?
No, there was a time. I grew up maybe a block from, maybe three blocks from a harbor, Edmonds Harbor. And so back then they didn't have fences all around everything. So, I mean, there must have been 40 docks there full of boats. So I used to cruise the boats every day, talk to the fishermen, talk to the guys that were sailing, talk to the guys that were having little funky little regattas. And it wouldn't have mattered what boat it was. It was a boat. It wouldn't have mattered if it was a schooner, a tugboat, or a little, you know, racing sailboat, or a submarine. I was fascinated with it when I was a little guy. So when I went to Alaska...
And that was after high school?
Nope. That was between my freshman and sophomore year.
Okay.
Bob, the guy I fished for, he had an aluminum boat. He had an old Marco boat. And it was at the time, I mean, nowadays I would call it the old boat, but at the time it was a Cadillac. It was a really sweet, beautiful boat. And I got fascinated with the fact that aluminum was indestructible, that it was such a workhorse material. It wasn't like wood. It wasn't like fiberglass. It wasn't like any of the other odd composites, plastics, and things that they've come out with these days. It is a workhorse. You can do anything you want to it, and it soaks it up. And I got fascinated with the utility aspect of aluminum boats. So when I got out of high school, I went up, fished a season. When I came home, I made about $5,400, which back then was a bunch of money, which was a lot of money. It was good money. Like, I had a ton of money. And I put myself through welding school and focused on aluminum. I can weld anything else, but aluminum boats specifically were my fascination. And that's how we got to doing what I'm doing.
And so, did you start a business, or did you go to work for someone? Did you stay in Puget Sound?
I immediately got a job the next day I got out of school, I immediately got a job with a small boat building company that was just opening up. They had just opened their doors. They were just unpacking everything. It was, if you believe in fate, which,
mm-hmm,
I had a lot of job offers. I was going to make gold circuit boards for NASA and blah, 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 and all these things. And I made this cold call to this place that wanted aluminum welders. And the guy said, get down here right now. So I came down. You're the only guy that's called and tried to get a job here. And so I said, I'll take it. I passed the weld test, and I started the next day. And we built little boats, 16s, 18s, 19s, 21s. And they were just little runabouts for the Navy, and they were mostly government boats, and I had hit the Holy Grail right out of high school.
Exactly.
This was it. And then the guy that was running the place, which he had only been there 2 weeks and I had only been there a week, he just up and quit. He went, I don't like the owner. I'm going back to Idaho, which he lives here somewhere. I don't know where. I'm going back to Idaho. I'm out of here. It's all yours. So here I was thrown into this boat building thing. We had only built a couple of boats, and I worked there for a long time. I worked there 3.5 years, and then George I think George's idea was to build a business and sell it, make a really viable business that was making a ton of money, and then dump it. And that's what he did. We worked at Quijac. I worked at Workskiff for 4 years, including the time I was at Quijac, and then he sold it to them because they wanted a little boat they could turn and burn. So then I went to Quijac, which is where really my life started, which was a, such a good thing for me. It was a great company to get on with. And
What is Quijac for those who aren't into the boat world?
So Quijac, they make big commercial stuff. So big, 135 to 150 foot stuff. Big commercial ferries, passenger vessels, work boats. They made lots of work boats. They made a lot of commercial boats. And the best part of it was, so they bought WorkSkiff. I started that there. We moved shop down to the Quijac place, and they I was doing the WorkSkiff thing in Quijac, and then I moved into the Quijac part and started building these big boats, and I ended up getting Coast Guard certified, which was the best part, it's a very rare welding certification to get, and I didn't know it at the time, but it was a really big deal. And then I got sent to Hawaii.
If you're just tuning in, I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and my guest is Jim Christensen, and we're sitting in his huge workshop in Ashton, Idaho, talking about his life and his loves and his passion for fly fishing. We jump back into my conversation with Jim Christensen. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Then I got sent to Hawaii in 2002, and so.
And how old were you then?
Well, let's see, 91. I was 18, so I kind of have to do it like that.
That's okay.
27.
Okay.
And
so you had kind of had like a college education in welding for this small company, the big company, and now you're a man of the world, and they send you to Hawaii. And was it because of the Navy certification that you went to Hawaii? Okay.
Yeah. So a boat that I had worked on that I had built in Seattle had an accident in Hawaii, and the guy just made a cold call to the only person he had in his phone book, and I probably would have been the only one that would have gone too. And he said, "Jim, you want to come out to go Hawaii for a couple weeks?" And I said, "Well, yeah, I'm on my way. You know, I'm already there." And so I had a brand new girlfriend. I mean, We've been together four years. And we hopped on a plane. He got his plane ticket and everything. We left. And it was, you know, Hawaii was amazing. It was really amazing for us. It was me and my soon-to-be wife's new... It was like that door opening to possibilities that everyone needs in their day, mm-hmm. in their life, that
new perspective.
Yeah. And it was completely different because we were both from Seattle. It was completely different. Like the lifestyle, the language, the work ethics, the people, I mean, everything. You're surrounded by the ocean now. It's hot instead of an ocean. It's cold. There's no rain. And so you came from rain and there's sun all day and you're clearly not meant for the sun because I have sunburned legs right now.
And what island were you?
I got sent to Maui. They have the biggest, you would think it would be Oahu with Waikiki, mm-hmm. you know, 1.8 million people, but the actual largest tourist fleet. Now, I'll back up. So I got Coast Guard certified. Now, Coast Guard certified means that you can weld on any vessel that takes out paying passengers.
Okay.
And not just any aluminum boat. You can weld on any aluminum boat too, but to weld on a Coast Guard certified vessel, you have to have, it has to be a boat that takes out paying passengers, people that aren't assuming the liability of going out on, they put you in charge, so they trust you. Mm-hmm. And so Maui has the largest tourist fleet, the largest aluminum tourist fleet. And so I went there, and the guy I was working for had five boats, and there was another five other boats in the harbor, and so it was a good thing. And almost immediately he told me, "You know what, Jim, I will allow you to charge me twice as much if you get your own business." So he was paying me really good money. It was twice what I was making in Seattle. And the reason is he didn't have to pay for my, it was a better thing.
Like taxes, insurance,
yeah,
and all
just,
that. Yeah.
It was just all around better. And he actually cared. I mean, me and him are best friends to this day. And he actually wanted me to have a better life also. And at the time I was young and I was, you know, worked really hard. But when you're young, you can't see the bigger picture that people are trying to put in front of you. And Dave knew that. He could see that there was a bigger picture for me. So anyways, I got my own business, got a little LLC and the whole nine yards, started charging him double. And everyone else in the harbor, suddenly I was the only Coast Guard certified, still to this day I am, the only Coast Guard certified welder in Hawaii. So this doorway just banged open, crashed open, like the phone rang off the hook. Now that I'm on the market, it was outrageous. There was so much work and so much money, and it came uncorked, and it was a good thing. It was a really good thing.
And so what started as kind of a 2-week come over to Hawaii, fix this one boat, how long did you end up then?
15 years.
15 years?
Yeah,
wow.
15 years. We would only leave for 2 weeks each year. We worked 7 to 11.
7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
Yeah, 7 days a week. There's no question about it. Here's the problem. No, here's not the problem. Here's... So you know everyone in the world has their shot at stardom.
Okay,
everyone, I believe this. Every single person I've ever talked to has had that one moment in their life where they made a bunch of money and they could have taken it one way. And some people, I don't know, make the mistake, mess it up, do something wrong, stick with it, doesn't really matter. But that was my shot at being a really good thing in my life. It was what I was meant to do.
And you had celebrity status with your training.
And in Hawaii, like I was, I'm not going to brag about myself, but phone rang off the hook. Mm-hmm. It was unreal. It was crazy. I was going inter-island, jumping out of helicopters, like going, Tonga. I've been to all the South Seas islands working on boats because they couldn't find anyone else. And if they did find someone else from the mainland, they probably were losing their job because they were taking this job. So,
because that's the thing. If you're working 11 to 7 for 15 years, mm-hmm. the part of the story you're not saying is you must have sacrificed.
Every year we took 2 weeks, okay. 3 weeks, sometimes even a month. It would, towards the end, we were taking a month. We were also working on our marriage, which was in shambles. But we were taking time off for each other and to fix what we had lost by working.
But were you always going fishing then? Two weeks a year?
No, we went to we always planned it around her family reunion and then a trip through the West here fishing. And I mean, we fished just about all the rivers here.
So you knew of this area before you left Maui. So what brought you to the decision that we're done and giving up this life on Maui that a lot of people would say, is there nirvana? I mean, for a lot of people, they're shooting for that dream. So what brought you to the end?
First of all, the realization that there's no future in Hawaii. The thought, we're husband and wife. We just gotten married. We were super happy and holding hands, running through the daisies and that kind of thing. We wanted little kids, right? Like, doesn't everyone want little kids and little,
make your little life.
Yeah, family. Little girls with pigtails and that kind of thing, and a white picket fence. And so we did. We bought a huge home out here that was perfect. And so we were going to work enough in Hawaii to pay the whole thing off, to pay the house off, and save up enough money to have kids. And I would move the whole shop here and work what I do nowadays, which is about an hour a day.
and that's a big change.
It is. Like, I got up at 11, so, and I get up at 11 every day, and then I come out here and goof around, and all I need is enough to get through the day. If I had kids and stuff, it'd be a different story. It would be 9 to 9 every day, but I'm by myself. So you
came to Chester married, mm-hmm. with the idea that now we're going to start our family in this, and mm-hmm. we're going to fish until we can fish no longer and live out our life happily. Then what happened?
We got married in 2005. We went there in 2002. We got married in Hawaii in 2005. We bought a home. We bought the big house in 2007, early 2007. We never really even saw the house until 2011. We just couldn't take time off. There was just no... And herein lies the big problem with how everything unfolded to where I... not where I am in a bad way, but where we both are in our world. We bought the house to get the house, but then we were going to pay. The plan was to stay in Hawaii, and when you're young, you don't really pay attention to the fact that you can't. Nobody has enough patience to pay off the house, and have a happy life. And herein lies the whole reason that I'm not in the big house right now and I'm not in Hawaii. It is that it's unrealistic, but you don't know that until you don't learn to stand up until you've fallen down. That's why toddlers, they stagger, stagger, fall down, stagger, stagger, fall down. Finally, the next time they're walking. We all have to go through our bumps and bruises in life to get to what we know. Like old people, nobody listens to old people, but they're our best asset, you know. Save your money, don't, you know.
You had your grandma.
Don't take any wooden nickels.
Exactly.
Like that.
Your grandma was your guide for a long time.
Yeah, she was hard, though. Both my mom and my grandmother were not... I really hate to say this. This is awful for me to say. And I don't mean it in a bad way, but they were not loving people. They were... My grandmother's a Depression-era woman, so her pain was directly deposited on my mom. So my mom's fear of, you know, always there's always a possible depression coming around the corner was dumped on me. So at 14, I had a job. I mean, when my mom could get me a paper route, she got me the paper route. And I was, you know, kicked in the face in bed, said, you got to go do your paper route. And so, you know, both of these women put me into situations that at the time I was like, I was tickled. I was excited to have this opportunity. But looking back on it, it wasn't so much for my opportunity as it was for my training to, and I'm not bragging about being a good worker. I was a very good worker for a very long time. But their lesson was to teach me the circle of money, the circle of life, the produce something, get something, produce something, get something. There's no reward for nothing. So
it's clearly at some point there was something missing in that message for you, right? And that must have come to a head when you got to Chester and left Hawaii.
So we tried to move home. We bought the house. We bought the house in early 2007, and both of my wife. We'll back up here. So working, you know, a marriage is a very interesting thing. It's the ultimate commitment, and nobody takes it as seriously as they should. And me and Rachel, I've had people come up to me in Lahaina Harbor, and they said, I can't believe what happened to you and Rachel. I cannot believe you guys are not together anymore. You gave, and I know this sounds, people are going to go, oh, that's stupid, that's... Rachel's had the same thing. People that went, I cannot believe you and Jim aren't together. You guys gave everyone that we knew. Like, you guys were the perfect couple. And we thought we were the perfect couple. We had good money. We were both fairly good looking. We had a little boat. And whenever
we had similar interests.
Yeah, we had similar interests. When we went scuba diving every day, when we went scuba diving, we would always hold hands. When someone went with us, we were always sitting next to each other. We never argued, never fought, or anything like that. And first of all, that's a red flag. Second of all, when you're fighting so hard for something that you want, which was to move home someday, you lose the fact that the person you're fighting for is standing right next to you. And me and Rachel, she was working 7 to 11. She was driving a boat in Lahaina Harbor, several boats in Lahaina Harbor. She got her captain's license and turned out to be an amazing boat captain, a stunning woman. Like, it brings tears to my eyes because she is absolutely one of the most amazing people out there. And we both lost sight of the only reason we got married and bought the house and moved to Hawaii was because at one point we were poor and holding hands every day, living in an apartment, you know, eating top ramen, and here we are living in Hawaii in a mansion eating filet mignon after work, after we've worked 11-hour days. And everyone, it doesn't matter how much money you have or how much time you have, people get lonely, people lose track of what happened. And it only takes, and I'm going to tell you, it only takes that one goof up, which my wife had. She had a real bad goof. And that was the catalyst for, you know, they say you can survive an infidelity and people can survive an infidelity. And I think some people can, but I think it's really tough. It's not really realistic to not have feelings to for the one person, me and her also, to not have her first mess up caused her to have lots of other mess ups. The depression,
it became a domino of shame.
Yes, the depression of her seeing me hurt caused her to feel worthless. And I'll be honest, I was not a nice person either. I was very hurt, and she heard my hurt. I never laid a hand on her, but I expressed a lot about how hurt I was. So this happened in 2007, early 2007, right after we bought the house, unfortunately. And we struggled for 3 years, and finally we decided let's try to move home at least for half the year. Let's go to the house. Let's live half the year at the house. And so we did. We packed up everything that wasn't furniture and stuff, you know, important stuff, clothing, motorcycles, welding equipment. And we moved home. We came home and it was fun. We had a good time here. And just like it is, just like the world is, when you leave a vacuum, you leave a voice, you know. And we both left vacuums in Hawaii. And the phone, you know, just like it would, rang off the hook. And
back to the 7 to 11.
Here we go. Like, you know, by the time, after 6 months, we were both actually going our separate ways. We had talked, you know, everyone talks themselves into, oh, it's going to be better. We're going to go. I'm just going to run back real quick and do a little bit of work. Oh, I'm just going to do this real quick. It's no big deal.
Just a few more hours.
Yeah, just you know, if I run back real quick and do this 1 week job, I'll be right back, no problem, and everything will be fine. And not everything's not fine, because it's more feeding of the fire of the resentment that both of you have for each other. And we just grew our separate ways. We lost the vision that we originally had when we were poor.
Just starting out?
Yeah, just starting out.
At the beginning of the journey?
Right. The vision that boys and girls have when they're first dating and they're happy and they're, you know, looking
at... The reason you say I do.
Yeah, exactly. It was, we lost the vision of that. And we went our separate ways.
You're listening to my guest, Jim Christensen. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I met Jim last summer on our road trip through Idaho and Montana and Utah and Oregon. And Jim was an incredible find, because I thought we were going to talk about fly fishing, which I was just getting to know. And I was really excited to learn some of the nuances about this hobby and why people are so drawn to the activity. But the conversation quickly turned, and Jim was so open and honest about his life and his experiences and what he's learned over his lifetime. And so we're going to continue our conversation with Jim Christensen in Ashton, Idaho. And you're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Well, the fish ain't biting, but the skeeters are. Little buggers gone hiding, they don't want to get caught. It's too nice a day to be dangling on the end of a line. That a bad day's fishing beats a good day's work every time. Little old worm around a big old hook. He don't mind the water in this Babylon brook. Just swimming around and having a flaming good time.
Moving home to the big house was officially, and neither one of us saw it, but we did see it, And we told everyone that it wasn't happening when they said it was happening, because when you're in it.
So your social group or your support group could see that things
absolutely,
were slipping.
Absolutely, because they see it black and white. They don't see it with all the colors of love and the colors of hand-holding and, you know, the promises that I'll be right back and this will be the last time. And the promises that are empty promises that you tried to do the right thing. We both tried to do the right thing by working. But
and I think that's really interesting, because what you keep circling around is, I think, what catches a lot of marriages is that you did the American dream the way you were taught to do the American mm-hmm. dream. If I am a man out there making money, supporting the family, buying the house, working really hard, then everything else is going to fall into place. Yeah. Isn't that the story you were told?
Yeah.
And so then when you get there and it doesn't work, then where do you go? Because then there isn't another turn.
Right.
And also what's interesting to back up is that you talked about, you know, your mom and your grandma, and there wasn't that loving piece. And so I would imagine that you put all that loving energy you had growing up into this relationship, right? That every feeling you ever didn't get to express when you were young lived in this person. So there was even that double.
So I've had four girlfriends in the whole life. So the first four girlfriends, one of them turned into my wife. So my first four girlfriends, I consumed my life with them. And obviously that didn't work out either, because that's not healthy either. But you don't know it at the time, so you do it. It's like putting out a fire. You don't know that you should let it burn out. You continue to fight it. Yeah, so the same thing with my wife. Even though this whole thing happened in 2007, we didn't get divorced until 2017.
Oh.
Yeah, no, I stuck with it. We stuck it out, and I thought there was a light at the end of the tunnel, and Rachel always knew there wasn't a light at the end of the tunnel. And you don't know it when that's the same thing about falling down. You just don't know how not to fall down until you've fallen down and skinned your knee. You don't know how to get back up and learn how to walk again.
So here you are now in 2019. How have you rebuilt? How have you stood back up? Who is Jim Christensen now?
Me now? Let's see. You know, I had a huge home. It was six bedrooms. It had a theater. It had, you know, it was on the river. It was just this monstrous, huge 4,000 plus square foot thing. And we were going to have the four kids, and we were going to have the picket fences, and we had nice cars and nice boats and that kind of thing. And again, I probably could have bought Rachel out. I probably could have bought her out of the big house. I probably could. We had so much equity into it that I probably could have bought her out of the big house. But again, I would have been forced to feed this gigantic house that you have created. And I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to do that. There's no joy in feeding an animal that's not going to give you back anything. You don't. Feeding a cow is one thing. Feeding a big monstrous house, some bank that owns it, and car payments and motorcycle payments and boat payments and all these payments that seems like everyone is okay with getting into. It's silly. It's silly. At the time, you want the white picket fence and little kids running around. You want them to have the best in life. But realistically, what does a child actually need? They need, let's see, a roof. They need clothing. They need food. And they need someone to pick them up when they cry. So you can do all of that in anything out there, but you don't see it until it's gone. You don't, right.
Because again, the cultural story is to go for more.
Especially in America. It's
the trap.
Yeah, it really is. They make it too easy to get too much. And now you're
trapped.
You're trapped. And I have friends here that every year they turn in their pickups. They're $80,000 diesel pickups. They get $40,000 for them. They turn them in for a new diesel pickup. They owe $40,000 again, so they've still got the $700-$800 payment for 7 years because their neighbor did it. And I get up at I don't get up at 11. That was kind of, you know, that was an exaggeration. I do get up at 11 in the wintertime because it's -40 out. But but everything I own, the equity I took in the house, my half of the equity in the house, I bought this little goofy little house, which is fun. It's a lot of fun. Built this beautiful shop.
A beautiful shop.
It really is. It's been such an amazing opportunity for me. I own all of it. There's a whole other shop upstairs. You know, we got to buy forklifts and have fun toys and not have the monkey on your back of payments and this trap that you get into. I mean, you can look at my shirt. I have holes in my shirt.
I think you had this shirt on the day I met you.
Yeah, I mean, all the seams have come loose on it and everything. But it keeps the sun off, and it I'm not poor. I've got money. I actually, you know, I just got back from a big job in Alaska and a big job in Hawaii, and I made probably what most of these people would make in 5 years. And so I could take 5 years off and not ever work, not have to work.
And would you allow yourself to do that?
I do. I'm doing that. I'm answering the phone as the customers come in, and I know the customers that I want to come in. So when they call, I answer the phone.
And so you finally stopped.
Yeah, I you know, out here there's a pile of wood. I cut my own wood. I own everything that's here, so I can make a living here at the shop.
Do you fish?
I fish every single day.
Let's get back to the heart of this.
Okay.
The heart of Jim was I was born to fish and hang around boats.
I was.
What are you doing now?
I go fishing every single day. We either, as in me and the dog,
priorities.
Yeah.
Your best friend.
Yes, my other wife here that is just the one most wonderful. We either go cut wood, we go for a drive in the woods, every single day we do something that most people get to do once a month.
2 weeks a year.
Yeah, exactly.
2 weeks a year, let's be honest.
2 weeks a year. I go fish. Like right now it's really hot and the fishing isn't that good, but from the minute the snow melts to the minute it's 90 degrees, I fish every single day. I go in the afternoon. I have a couple places I go down. I go down, I fool a couple of trout. I fool 20 trout, sometimes 100.
Is it catch and release?
Yeah, it's called catch.
So it's just for the hobby of it. Okay.
Yeah. And then in the fall, I fish every day. I mean, I fish right up until the snow has completely covered the river and the river's frozen over. And looking back, that is the reason we should be getting up in the morning, is to be what's best for us and not what's best for anyone else. You know, I'm 47 right now. I went to Hawaii when I was 27, and I don't know what happened for 20 years. It's all gone. It's the best years of my life are gone, and I could have been living the way I am.
But you don't think that 27 to 47 had to happen?
Oh, it had
so
to
that
happen.
You could get
oh, no,
here?
Of course it had to happen. So absolutely.
So it's not a regret, right?
No, it's not a regret. It's definitely not a regret. If I was going to say something to anyone, I would say, don't be so quick to follow the norm, which I did. You know, I tried to follow the norm and no.
If you're just tuning in, this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. I'm with my guest, Jim Christensen. And I guess I'm going to describe Jim as a Renaissance man, fisherman, welder, jack of all trades, and a bit of a, I guess at this point, you're a man of some wisdom at 47. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. All right, so I want to go back to the advice that you have to give, that, you know, looking at these last 20 years, and you started to say, don't be so quick to jump into the norm, but how do you not jump into the norm if from the time you're five, you're told, do this and life will work,
I think everyone has to have their car accident to see the light. I think some people, I mean, a lot of people are obviously born with. I mean, everyone's different, but I needed to get into my car accident, my divorce. I needed to have my whole life torn away from me so I could see what was best for me, what was best for me. Everyone has to go through hard times in their life to see what's really important, and what's really important is whatever's best for you.
And part of the journey is discovering what is best for you. Isn't that the whole process of life is kind of figuring out at the end of the day? And how interesting, at the end of the day, it was the thing you loved when you were 5 years old.
Yeah, you know, it's go full circle. Yeah. This little kid running down to the river every day trying to go fishing, and then you struggle all through your life. And you get to be a kid again when you're old, and generally you get to be a kid when you retire. I'm trying to be retired now. It's hard to say no to a lot of work, but
voice of the culture is still speaking
in your
ear.
It still is, yeah. And this tummy I have to keep, you know.
So can we talk fishing a little bit?
We can.
Because I know very little about fly fishing, but I've now had my hours of casting over the last few days.
Good.
I've gotten my, what would you call it, my line wet?
Uh-huh.
Sounds a little crude. But I made the mistake of, I mean, I understand the sport of it because I've been around it all my life. And, you know, I've watched Phil fish my entire life. So I understand the sport of it. But I kind of make a ha-ha joke the other day. I said, you know, the fish weren't biting, so why don't we throw a worm on it and just, you know, give the fish something to do and actually eat something, because it feels like you're just kind of toying with them, and maybe they're just tired of being toyed with. What is it about fly fishing?
You couldn't have asked a better person. Okay. You could not have come to a better place to ask a better question.
Okay, good.
Here we go.
All right.
The most amazing thing, the most fascinating thing to me about fly fishing is this fish is not eating because it's a big steak on a hook, something they've never seen before. Fish in rivers and lakes, streams have never seen animals, earthworms that grow inside the dirt. So we as fly fishermen, we sit down at a fly tying bench, we tie an exact replica of the bugs that they're eating at this time, whether it be tarpon in a bait fish pattern for tarpon in Florida, or it's a shrimp pattern for bonefish in the Bahamas, or a little itty bitty fly for a fish in Montana or Idaho or wherever, it doesn't matter, Scotland, it doesn't matter. But the idea that this fish didn't eat this because it was hungry, it ate it because it believed that your presentation, your imitation, the fly that you presented to them was so perfectly placed and so that they believed it was real. If you went down to pick up a $100 bill and it shocked you, that would be the game. That's the game. So you want to fool this fish on their level, not on your level. So they are super wary and they're watching everything, and the bugs that are coming down the river are in certain, they're in a certain life cycle, and you need to capitalize. So a trout won't take any bug. So there's all these bugs coming down the river, especially here on the Henry's Fork. We have multiple hatches overlapping that are really in-depth hatches, and each hatch has four life cycle stages that happen in about an hour and a half.
And the hatches are bugs or fish?
Yeah, the hatches are bugs. They're aquatic bugs that live in the bottom. They raise to the surface of the water. They come out as a dry fly. They sit on the water, dry their wings, kind of like a moth coming, like a butterfly coming out of a cocoon. They fly to the bushes, they mate, they return to the river. So there's the bug that's raising up, there's the one that's drying on the surface, there's the one that's returning to the surface to lay its eggs and dying. So you have all this there's all these life cycles, and each trout, now this is what, there's where it gets romantic. Mm-hmm. Each trout is on a certain life stage of that life cycle, which is happening in about an hour, hour and a half, sometimes all day, sometimes weeks on end. But you need to figure out what that trout's eating. Here's the romantic part, is that it's such an intimate sport. It's you against the fish, and he's smarter than you, and you need to fool him at his own game, which he's a professional at. And sometimes you get your butt kicked, and sometimes you have studied the hatch so well that you know what life cycle they're on at this moment, and you're watching a fish, and you're watching just one fish, and you tie that fly, you go home, you tie that fly, and you capitalize on him, and he makes a mistake, and you win the game. And so it's a really fun game of chess that is not sitting at a table. It's out one-on-one with a really, you know, a wary competitor. It's romantic. I think it's amazing. I love fly fishing. I grew up bait fishing because I was a little guy. You just, you know, splash, reel it back in, bang, fish is on it. But this fishing, you couldn't do like that. These fish are on their game. They're no joke. They're.
So what does fly fishing do for someone who, you know, how does it hook the person who becomes an avid fly fisherman? What is it about the sport that hooks you or anyone who does this?
You would have to be into that game of cat and mouse, of, I don't know, learning how to deceive the fish with their own weakness. I mean, you're capitalizing essentially on their weakness, and it's rewarding. It's a rewarding sport. Just the other day, after a couple of days down the river, we caught 54 fish, and
They're all catch and release.
Yep, we released every single fish. I haven't kept a fish in, I don't know, a long time, probably 30 years. It's not about that. It's about, if we had kept a fish, we'd have to stop fishing, first of all. Second of all, it's a game. It's a worthy adversary that you won against, and it's you have respect for this fish. This fish is like super smart. And some of these fish we sat on for half an hour, changing flies, trying to figure out what this guy was doing. We could see him doing things, but we couldn't see. Finally, boom, there he is. He fell for it. Dum, 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 dum. That's the game right there.
Do you make eye contact with that fish once you pull it out of the water and have a moment together?
It is nice. not to that extent, but it is nice to have, you know, you land the fish and you hold it and you can feel that it's sappy, but you can feel them, you know, you feel it's a live animal and it is nice.
So what has fly fishing brought to you? What has it done for your mental health?
It is everything. I go down. I think a lot. I have a hard time letting go of, I have a hard time not overthinking everything in the world. So I'm standing in the river and I'm going through all kinds of little projects and things and my past and future and things like that. It's a quiet way of getting. Plus, it's also very competitive for me. It's good fun.
It's a little bit of meditative mindfulness.
Yeah.
And then it sparks your desire to be a winner.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah.
Do you compete? Is there a fly fishing? No. Okay.
There are fly fishing, but I wouldn't do that. I'm not that level. Those guys are. I'm a hobby guy. It's a hobby for me. It's not a thing. But there are guys that do it. There's competitions all over the world.
And so, my last couple of questions. Mm-hmm. We're sitting here in your shop in Ashton, Idaho, looking at these aluminum boats that you clearly created with love.
And my own designs.
And your own designs, yeah. Okay. And so, what are these boats designed to do?
Both of these are river boats. One's a rowboat. It's called a drift boat. This is for a local guy. It's a boat. There's another one against the wall I haven't put together yet, but this is for a local guy. It's a boat that's specifically made for our rivers out here. It's real low sided. Wind does not affect it, so it's a rowboat. It's human powered. Seats three guys. One is a rower, and then this is a jet boat. It's a motorized boat to run up and down the river. Runs real shallow draft. I'm into the fishing thing, so I'm also into the riverboat thing. I did a huge boat here this spring. It was from that door to that door, and it was that tall, and it was as wide as that door was.
So what would the dimensions be, just?
It was 25 by 10 and a half. And it went to Seattle. Went to a guy in Seattle, and he takes people offshore and fly fishes for tuna with it, and it's a fun project. So I'm not specifically just riverboats. It's just boats in general. They're romantic. A boat is... I would imagine I would put it towards someone that rides motorcycles. It's probably everyone has a car, but not everyone has something that gets them away, like a boat or a motorcycle or a hang glider or a plane does.
Kind of that independence, right?
Yeah, and they're neat. When you go into a different world that's not the street, not outside the city, there's something about it. Boats are fun. They're really a... There's the love. Half of our lives are spent on boats. I mean, that's how humans got from this continent to that continent. So they took boats. I mean, boats are romantic. They're a romantic piece of equipment.
I think that Jim Christensen is a romantic. I think part of the story is, see, there's fish, there's boats, and there's love.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's all you need to be content.
Yeah. Yeah, there's...
You seem happy.
No, I am happy. I am really happy. I couldn't have asked for it any better. There was a time when I kept telling myself this is fake happiness because I don't have my wife. I don't have all these things that, you know, that I was supposed to have.
That defined your early life.
Yeah, exactly. That, I can't be happy without Rachel. I can't be happy without... And I am in a really, really good place. the fire inside me finally calmed down. It went out, and the anger and the resentment and the things went away. And I think that happens with everyone. Everyone has to go through their awful times to get to their good times. And I sleep good. I fall asleep. You never used to fall asleep. I used to twiddle my thumbs. And yeah, I'm in a good place. I love my life. I couldn't ask for a better life.
I love that.
Yeah.
Thank you for sitting down with me and sharing your life story.
Of course.
You've been listening to my conversation with Jim Christensen, Renaissance man, fisherman, boat builder, and man of a great big heart. And I want to leave you with one more story about Jim, because at the beginning of our visit, I mentioned that his cowboy boots really stood out for me, that I loved that he wore these big, chunky cowboy boots with a pair of shorts and a Hawaiian shirt and just owned the world. And I said, I love those boots so much that I'm going to make sure that my husband finds a pair at some point along our trip. And Jim said, what size are you? And my husband laughed, and Jim ran to the back of his house and grabbed a matching pair of cowboy boots and gave them to my husband and said, take these. These are for you. And that incredible gesture has stayed with me for this entire year. And my husband has worn those boots exclusively for the entire year, with shorts, with jeans, with every outfit he can put them with. And so Jim has stayed with us, and the conversation has stayed with us, and that act of kindness and generosity has inspired me. So thank you to Jim. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and I'll be back next Tuesday at 2. Thank you for listening and supporting Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Oh, catfish in the lake, we called him Big Jim. When I was a kid, my only wish was to get my line in him. Skipped church one Sunday, rode out and throwed in my line. Jim took that hook pole and me right over the side. Went drifting down past old tires and rusty cans of beer. The angel of the lake whispered in my ear, before you choose your wish, son, you better think first. With every wish, there comes a curse. I fell in love with beautiful Doreen. She was the prettiest thing this old town'd ever seen. I courted her and I made her mine, but I grew jealous whenever another man come walking down. My jealousy made me treat her mean and cruel. She said, Bobby, oh, Bobby, you're such a fool. Don't you know, before you choose your wish, you better think first. 'Cause with every wish, there comes a curse. Sit around and laugh at many rivers I cross, but on the far banks there's always another forest where